Thank you.
And we will move on to the fifth case of the day, United States versus Kevin Taylor. Mr. Angelo?
May it please the court, counsel. I'm going to try and hit two issues today, but if I have time, I'm going to hit a third one. The first two issues I'd like to discuss is the special verdict issue, and the second issue I'd like to discuss is the count regarding aiding and abetting. Specifically regarding the special verdict issue, one thing is certain, something went wrong. Admitted both by Taylor and the government, the mutually exclusive finding of facts by the jury were completely missed. Upon the request of the government, the jury was given a special verdict form to be asked whether the drug amount involved in counts 1 or 2 were over 50 grams or between 5 and 50 grams. And as you know, by reading the briefs, both special verdicts were answered in the affirmative. Accordingly, the jury found at the same time that Taylor was responsible for an excess of 50 grams, while at the same time he was responsible between 5 and 50.
Furthermore, the phrasing of the verdict form, was that inconsistent? I understand the instruction said answer only one of them.
Correct.
Was the phrasing inconsistent? Did it say between 5 and 50, or did it just say more than 5?
It said, if you find that the amount of cocaine base in the form commonly referred to as crack cocaine, which was the subject matter of the distribution, did not exceed 50 grams, then you must decide whether it exceeded 5 grams. So they are mutually exclusive.
That's the instruction.
No, that's what the actual special verdict form reads.
Yeah, that's the instruction on the form.
Yes.
Okay, but I'm saying the question was, how was the question, the second question phrased? Okay, I'm sorry. Okay, I'm with you now. I follow you. Okay, go ahead.
Return. And as a result, when the district court discharged the jury, he never recognized the jury's finding between 5 and 50. He only recognized the jury's finding in the excess of 50. And furthermore, the pre-sentence investigation report, made the same error. It only recognized that the jury found above 50 grams and not between 5 and 50. As a result, the PIR concluded that Taylor's relevant conduct based on those two counts was over 16,000 kilograms of marijuana equivalents, which calls for a base offense level of 36. And however, based upon a note in USG 2D1.1, comment N, it's reduced two levels because multiple drugs were added together and multiplied. So it was originally base 36, reduced to 34. However, due to the perjury two-level enhancement, it was brought back up to 36. And the judge adopted the PIR and sentenced Taylor to 180 months on count 1 and 2. And in doing so, the judge exceeded his proper authority when he sentenced Taylor pursuant to the special verdict form in excess of 50 grams, as noted in the relevant conduct in the PIR.
Mr. Angelo, let me, on the special verdict issue, do you agree that the sentence that the judge imposed was within the statutory range for an amount of crack in excess of 5 but less than 50 grams?
He actually went a little bit easy on him, I believe.
Sorry?
He went below, I think 8 months below.
I'm not asking about guidelines. Okay. I'm asking about the statutory minimum and maximum. It was within that range.
Yes.
Why doesn't that solve any Apprendi problem?
It's not per se a strict Apprendi. It's the nature of Apprendi. It's the nature of Booker, as you cited, how it offends. And as noted in Macedo, it offended. They used the guideline range as a factor in doing so.
Well, I mean, even if the jury had come back and said it was not above 50 grams, would you agree that the judge could still make his own findings in applying the guidelines and say it was above 50 grams, his relevant conduct?
I would not, because the exception in which the judge can make a sentence above and beyond to include other drugs in relevant conduct that the jury does not hear, that only applies if there's actually other relevant conduct to come in. There was no other relevant conduct that the...
Would you agree that the judge can consider acquitted conduct in applying the guideline calculations?
I believe so, yes.
Okay. I know a lot of people don't like it, but that's pretty well-established law at this point.
Yes. However, in the instant case, there was no, I don't believe there was any other acquitted conduct or any other
No, what
evidence.
We've got is, you know, you've got, the government has a stronger position here because we've got answers to both of the questions, saying both between 5 and 50 and above 50, right? So I'm having trouble seeing the constitutional problem as long as the sentence was within the statutory maximum for the between 5 and 50 gram range.
Understood. However, the reasoning based upon giving the sentencing judge the mobility to sentence, to add more drugs into the relevant conduct that the jury did not hear, in the sense that if there's other acquitted conduct that exists and the jury doesn't hear it, the judge can still use that for sentencing purposes.
I'm confused as between acquitted conduct and uncharged conduct.
Both are also.
Both can be considered.
Both can be considered.
Right.
Okay.
So what's wrong with this?
Well, in this case, there is no extra evidence by which the judge went above and beyond. So the reasoning to allow the sentencing judge to take outside and or acquitted evidence in does not exist here. It's potentially a narrow exception to that rule. When there is no additional evidence, acquitted conduct, other drug amounts that the judge can use by a preponderance of the evidence to go above and beyond.
Maybe we're not communicating.
Okay.
If there's acquitted conduct, that's a generous way of describing the conflict between the two verdict forms.
Okay.
But if there's acquitted conduct, the jury has heard the evidence, has said we're not convinced beyond a reasonable doubt, and the sentencing judge can still consider that and say, I'm going to apply the guidelines anyway, including that amount, correct?
Correct.
So why is this any worse?
I don't believe it's any worse. No, because it's taking, again, the preponderance of the evidence standard against a reasonable doubt standard.
Okay.
I'm into my rebuttal time. Reserve some time, please.
You can reserve as much as you want. All right. Thank you, Mr. Angelo. And Mr. Norwood for the government.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court and counsel. Your Honor, in this case, even if there were no special verdict form at all, the district court judge's sentence would be appropriate under Apprendi. The reason for that is the statutory maximum, even if there was no special verdict form for a case involving crack cocaine, would be 20 years, and that would be under subsection C. So even if there were no special verdict form at all, the statutory maximum is 20 years. Judge Gilbert sentenced the defendant to 180 months. So there's no Apprendi violation, even in the absence of any confusion with the special verdict form.
Why didn't somebody bring this little problem with the special verdicts to Judge Gilbert's attention?
Your Honor, I was not trial counsel. I am not certain why it was not brought to his attention. I have used a
not
sim-
my problem. Yeah.
Well, it's, no, it's the government's problem. It's
it
our office's,
in your lap.
It's our office's problem, yes, Your Honor. The special verdict form, I went back and checked the special verdict form that I have used in cases, and on the special verdict form, after the first question, I also include a line, if you answer this question, yes, please stop. I mean, Judge Gilbert explained to him what they needed to do, and I think in this case, especially where the defendant stipulated, especially to count two, that the amount of crack cocaine involved was 198 grams, that they had to find over 50 grams. But regardless, if there were no...
Juries are extra thorough, so...
I think that's what happened.
They're just trying
to
be nice. They just answer yes to everything.
But even if there were no special verdict form at all, this sentence itself would not violate Apprendi because it was less than 20 years. I know there's an issue with respect to aiding and abetting. Our brief explains what the government's position is, and I'm not sure what the defendant was going to argue before this court. If the court has any questions on that, I think that that's probably the more difficult count of anything in this brief.
Well, on the aiding and abetting issue, I'll obviously want to hear what Mr. Angelo has to say as well. If we were just talking about a straight transaction where Taylor drives Mr. Blake up to Ivory's house, drops him off for the deal, if you didn't have the conspiracy charge and the later wiretaps, that wouldn't be enough, would it?
If the only evidence was that person A, or in this case the defendant, drove somebody somewhere and the other person got out and did something, and that was the only evidence, completely in isolation, it would be a much more difficult position for the government, and I would agree that may not rise to aiding and abetting.
Say that but, doesn't.
but in this case, there was additional evidence. There was a deal 5 days before where the defendant drove Blake to deal crack cocaine the defendant's truck. The defendant participated in passing the drugs to, I believe it was Ivory on that occasion. That was 5 days before the transaction in which he was convicted of aiding and abetting. And I guess I was thinking about the defendant's position that they're not challenging the conviction on count one. If in trying to sort of trying to correlate that with the defendant's testimony that he never sold crack cocaine, well, if he was convicted of a conspiracy and he didn't actually sell crack cocaine, what was his role in the conspiracy? It would be that of renting cars, it would be that of driver, it would be that of collecting money, which was his role in the aiding and abetting offense. So even if you take the defendant's word as true, which obviously the government doesn't, that he never, quote, sold crack cocaine, then his role in the conspiracy would be that of driver, which he did on this particular transaction that he was convicted of aiding and abetting on. If the court has any other questions, thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Norwood. Rebuttal, Mr. Angelo.
Just a brief argument coming back to the special verdict issue. The grams, the cocaine that was involved with that, the vast majority of that was from the aiding and abetting charge. Only crack cocaine produced in all this, with the extensive evidence, the video surveillance, the ATF informants, paid informants, you name it, the only crack cocaine that was produced was from October 20th, 2005, which is about 5 or 6 months before you get into all these wiretaps and video evidence. And lastly, on the special verdict, as cited in our brief, the Macedo case applied Apprendi to the sentencing guidelines. And I'm just going to move on to address what you wanted to regarding aiding and abetting. The government's burden has to prove that he had the intent of Blake and that he affirmatively acted to make that venture succeed. And as a matter of law, the government failed on both prongs. Their only evidence to establish Taylor's intent on that day comes from, again, 6 months later, 5 months later. They try and post-date the wiretaps.
But the jury found that he was part of a conspiracy through that six-month period, right?
Yes.
Why doesn't that support the inference that on that date he was also carrying out the conspiracy?
Well, in terms as also cited in our brief, we disagree with the notion that you have to challenge the underlying conspiracy in order to knock out the aiding and abetting. Number one, it would clear Taylor's...
I'm sure you don't have to as a matter of law.
Right.
But here, where the question is Taylor's knowledge and intent when he drops Blake off at Ivory's house.
Right.
Why isn't evidence consistent with the course of the whole conspiracy that was found relevant?
Well, they weren't even really looking at Taylor until 5 or 6 months later when they started doing all the videotaps. And I'm trying to... Could you repeat the question, please?
Well, one way of interpreting this is to say, no, they weren't looking at him at the time because they didn't have enough evidence against Taylor at that point. But as the investigation continued and they gathered more evidence and got him on the wiretaps, they realized, yeah, he did know what was going on. And they charged him with the conspiracy in the whole period. You've got the transaction 5 days earlier, so it's reasonable to infer that this drop-off of Blake was part of the whole scheme.
Well, regarding October 15th, I think that's a good issue to bring up, is that The government did not rely on that testimony primarily. That was brought out by Taylor's counsel on cross. The government came back with that argument in their response brief, saying that October 5th, say if you take the 15th, the 20th, and then the wiretaps, that can bring it all together. But that was never the issue of the indictment, and that was never relied on by them at trial.
Well, the jury could rely on it, right?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Angelo.
Thank you for your time.
And, Mr. Angelo, you served by court appointment in this matter, is that correct?
I did.
You have the thanks of the court for an excellent job, and an excellent job by both counsel in this case. Thank you.
Thank you.